Jerry is going to serve us this afternoon on the subject, Greater Than Cyrus. Greater Than Cyrus. Lord bless Brother Jerry.
Thank you, Brother Doris. First of all, we want to bring you the love and greetings from Portland class, just 45 minutes down the road. Sister class to Salem, and they send their love with Psalms 9, verses 1 and 2. Psalms 9, 1 and 2. I will praise thee, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will show forth all thy marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in thee. I will sing praise to thy name, O thou most high. Also, this convention is a special convention for me because I was immersed here 58 years ago along with Sister Joy and Sister Pam and Brother Tom Brantner, who just finished his course this week. Also, we bring you the love and greetings from our son and daughter-in-law, Aaron and Sarah, in Columbus, Ohio, and also Brother Bill Harp, who we visited yesterday. We might just proceed the lesson with a little bit of what prompted us to have this lesson. We wanted to point to a greater than Cyrus in symbol, and also to establish where he was in the point of history and why he was there, and to confirm particularly the evidence in volume 2 of in the whole chain of history as it leads to the Bible history. Consecutive links lead all the way to Cyrus and stop where we are given then secular history. There are alternatives suggested, but the lesson is not intended to address or try to unravel those alternatives, but merely to confirm and establish our confidence in the volume timeline. So, let's see if I can figure out how this little gizmo works. First of all, we want to consider what preceded and precipitated the fall of Jerusalem and Israel's dispersion to Babylon, yet with a hope and promise of returning to their temple. Secondly, who was Cyrus and the forces that would conquer Babylon? Thirdly, the prophetic events and dating the fall of Babylon as linking the crossroads between Bible and secular history and chronology. And fourth, the importance to Israel of the Cyrus decree and the greater of Cyrus now. Well, long before Cyrus were some words from Jeremiah. They were penned from Egypt after he was carried out of Israel along with the fleeing remnant of revolutionaries after the death of Gedaliah. The remainder were taken to Babylon, yet here was a promised thread of hope for one day to return from Babylon, as we read in Jeremiah 50, 5 through 8. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces toward thitherward, saying, come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten. My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. They have turned them away on the mountains and have gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. Well, Jeremiah had witnessed the rise of Babylon, the great power with roots way back in history. Sadly, Israel had forsaken the God who had brought them out of Egypt and the spirit of the Mosaic Law. The Lord was about now to allow them to learn the full consequences of their wayward course. The Spirit of the Lord was transporting the mind of Jeremiah to a time beyond his day and this sad hour of Israel's history. Israel's long removal to Babylon was just beginning. He was given a glimpse of the time when the process would be reversed. But because of the long years to ensue, many would forget their way back to Zion by another generation of visionaries. Jeremiah had the writings of Isaiah for more than a century before himself. The clues are in Isaiah the 13th chapter, with a message for Babylon of his day and the Babylon of the last days. Here in verses 1, 4, 5, 11, and 13 are a few extracts. I think it is this one. Okay. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see, the noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdom of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. Behold, the Lord says in verse 17, I will stir up the Medes against him. What a remarkable prophecy for the time of these words. The Medes were themselves a subject people under the Assyrians, and Persia was not even a major empire considered in the days of Isaiah. Yet Isaiah revealed the name of the man who would rise from Persia and surpass Media, then form an alliance with those Medes to end Israel's 70 years in Babylon. Every few years, actually every few centuries, there appears on the stage of history one who truly makes a difference for humanity. The coming of Cyrus resulted in the downfall of Babylon and the recovery of Israel. Again, in Isaiah 45, the prophet was prompted to speak of Cyrus as the Lord's anointed, his Messiah, or as the Greek version of the scriptures, his Christ. In Isaiah 45, 1-4, we read this. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked place straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron, and I will give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel's mine elect, I have called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. This prophetic Cyrus was not even yet born in Isaiah's day. Cyrus was born in about 580 BC, some 250 years after Isaiah, then rose to power even in the shadow of the Medes. Then he turned away from Media and formed his own Persian kingdom. With intermarriages, he formed an alliance known as the Medo-Persian Empire. He was a Persian king for about 30 years, from 559 to 529 BC. Revealing his name before his birth is no reason to doubt the Isaiah text. The Greek form of the name Isaiah is Kyrios, meaning Lord. In Persian, it has the meaning of one like the sun. Here is the Lord's anointed for the prophetic work. Here was the God of the Jews calling him his shepherd and promising him victory over Babylon and deliverance of Israel. But the Lord was, of course, using Cyrus to demonstrate his own great wisdom, foresight, and power over the kings of the earth. So now Jeremiah lived to see his people taken and the land desolated for their unfaithfulness, according to the prophecies. The land must enjoy the designated Sabbaths because Israel's neglected the ordinance of Sabbaths and Jubilees. Jeremiah watched from afar. He didn't even live to see this Cyrus who was revealed to his predecessor Isaiah. Still, his own prophetic vision forecast the judgment upon the oppressor of his people. Babylon would be overthrown, the people delivered from the great Cyrus. Their release from Babylon and return to their own land was a remarkable period in history, yet not half so remarkable as the greater deliverance prefigured, a deliverance in our day. Only the ruined walls of Babylon remained in the days of the Apostle John on Patmos. Yet in vision he saw another Babylon rise again. He watched a further captivity take place, and then a wonderful reversal of these events under the direction of another anointed of Jehovah, the Christ, of whom Cyrus was but a prefigure. As Jeremiah saw the rise of that ancient power of Babylon, so the John class of this age, the church, saw the rise of the same old system of religious and temporal power, only in a new, more formidable form. Hyslop, in his book, The Two Babylons, demonstrated just how apt the title of Babylon is to describe the great church-state system of another age. The great papal system made war against the saints to overcome them, just as did Nebuchadnezzar against the Jews. Let us walk through the events of this ancient transfer of power and see how those bound by the rivers of Babylon found their freedom and how the greater than Cyrus has freed his people in these end times. Here was a man of courage, determination, and even faith in his destiny. The principal historical sources come to us from the Greek historian Herodotus, Xenophon, and Ctesias, who lived in the 5th century BC, within earshot of the events. Here is what we can piece together as authentic and in accord with the scriptures. After his dynasty was recognized in Asia Minor, Cyrus moved westward to subdue the holdouts against his domain. Babylon and its supporters were the first universal empire of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of glory. In Daniel's dream of the ram and the Persian horn, the Persian horn became higher than the Median horn. Cyrus the Persian came against the Babylonian Empire. For a short time, he arranged a co-regency to coexist with Media, who would soon die of its own accord anyway. Yet it is regarded as the Medo-Persian Empire. It was shown in the chest and the two arms of silver of the great image, as with the ram, also with two horns. In Daniel 8, verse 3, But one horn was great higher than the other. It occupied the world stage for 200 years until Alexander the Great of Greece superseded Persia. Early in the year that we reckon 540 BC, Cyrus stood at the gates of the last western frontier, but Babylon was not invaded immediately. This year was spent in consolidating allies, resources, and securing vows of support, and removing the last resistance for a final assault on the fortress of Babylon. We will try to briefly quote some sources here from Xenophon, and I will not read them all because I want to pause a little later and just digest what we have seen and heard. We read from Xenophon, "Then the Cyrenes fell into strife and civil war with one another. They were entrenched in strongholds, and both sides called upon Cyrus for assistance. So while Cyrus himself stayed in Sardis to make siege engines," I should bring this up, here's the quote, "to bring up siege engines and battering rams to demolish the walls of such as would refuse to submit. Cyrus, leaving behind a large garrison of foot soldiers, started from Sardis in company with Croesus, and he took with him many wagons loaded with valuables of every sort." And we will not read the rest. But we continue. "On the way to Babylon, he subdued greater Phrygia and Cappadocia and reduced the Arabians to submission. From all these he secured armor for not less than 40,000 Persian horsemen, and many horses taken from the prisoners he distributed among all the divisions of his allies. And thus he arrived before Babylon with a great host of cavalry and a great host of bowmen and spearmen and multitude of slingers that was beyond number." Now we come to the year 539. There is much yet to do before entering the city. Nearly another year is used to construct a grand strategy, and so we continue with the Xenophon history. "Then, when they had encamped, Cyrus called together his staff officers and said, 'Friends and allies, we have viewed the city on every side, but I am sure I cannot see how one can take by storm walls so massive and so high. But does not this river flow through the midst of the city? And so the city is better defended by the river than by its walls.' One of his aides spoke to Cyrus and answered, 'Dig a ditch as wide and as deep as possible.' Accordingly, he took measurements in a circle round the city, leaving just enough room for the river for the erection of large towers, and began on either side of the city to dig an immense ditch, laying its foundations with the trunks of date palms. At last the ditches were completed. A certain festival had come around in Babylon, during which all Babylon was accustomed to drink and revel all night. Cyrus took a large number of men, as soon as it was dark, opened up the heads of the trenches to the river. As soon as that was done, the water flowed down through the ditches in the night. When the problem of the river was thus solved, Cyrus gave orders to his Persian colonels, infantry, and cavalry. He bade his aides, both foot and horse, to get into the channel of the river and see if it was possible to march in the bed of the river. 'Let us therefore enter in with dauntless hearts, fearing nothing.' When they were all wide awake and sober and fully armed, 'We are going to fall upon them at a time when many of them are asleep and many drunk, and none of them in battle array. Well, brethren, you know the rest of the story, confirmed by historians. Here is the historical precedent of Jesus' words in Matthew 24, 42 to 50, and also Revelation 18, verse 2. The thief and the householder, and the sentence upon mystical Babylon. Daniel 5 records Belshazzar's feasting, when the fingers of a man's hand mysteriously appeared and wrote unintelligible letters on the plaster wall. When the astrologers and magicians could not discern the meaning, Daniel was called before the king and promised a golden chain, a royal robe, and to be the third ruler in the kingdom if he could divine the meaning. But Daniel declined the offer and said for him to keep his gifts and give the rewards to others. Still Daniel gave the meaning, numbered, weighed, divided. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. That night the Cyrus forces entered the city on October 29 without resistance and slew this magistrate. But why is victory given to the Medes and the Persians? And why does Daniel 5, verse 31 say, and Darius the Mede took, the Hebrew is received, the kingdom, being about 62 years old? Well, the Cyrus operations were not independent of Media, and there is a clue in the correct Hebrew reading. Darius the Mede received the kingdom. He was not the military general and the strategist, but he received appointment and recognition in sharing the throne. As noted by Keelan DeLeetz, Barnes, Clark, Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Cyrus was previously risen to fame, not by mastering and subduing the Medes, but by striking a coalition by marriage of a Median daughter, and thus sealing an agreement of honor as long as his uncle by marriage should live. It seems Cyrus's own father, Cambyses, did the very same in marrying a Median daughter of Astyages. Students of the text say this was Cyaxares, son of Astyages, king of Media, and maternal uncle to Cyrus, who allowed him the title of his conquests as long as he should live. Thus it was the biblical Darius the Mede who was allowed rulership to continue his title while Cyrus the Persian consolidated his kingdom. Darius was 62 years old, while Cyrus was but 41 years old. Darius and Cyrus were not the same person. As noted in Daniel 8, verse 3, the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. So Cyrus the Persian horn would surpass the Darius Median horn. Daniel prospered in both the reigns of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus. Daniel 6, verse 28. We notice in Daniel 9, verse 1, that only the first year of Darius, of his rule in Babylon, is recorded as the son of Ahasuerus, being the title for the Median Astyages. His son being Cyaxares, that we know with the biblical name of Darius. Notice the expression that he was made, appointed king over the realm. This is the same as having received the kingdom in Daniel 5:31. This was part of the wisdom of Cyrus, who was biding his time. Darius was part of the old family and kingdom. Here is how I understand the family tree. For this reason, many students note these words of Xenophon in his history. We read, "And they continued their march and came near to Media. Cyrus turned aside to visit Cyaxares. The first thing Cyrus told Cyaxares was that a palace had been placed for him in Babylon, an official headquarters, so that he might occupy a residence of his own whenever he came there. Cyaxares then introduced to him his daughter, who brought to him a golden crown and bracelets and a necklace and the most beautiful Midian robe he could find. And the princess placed the crown on Cyrus' head, Cyaxares said, and the maiden herself, my own daughter, I offer you as well, Cyrus, to be your wife. Your father married my father's daughter, whose son you are, and with her I offer you all Media as a dowry, for I have no legitimate issue." So the city walls of Babylon fell in late 539. But Darius assumed the throne as a weak caretaker in a transition government. His council is arranged for Daniel's night with the lions in Daniel the sixth chapter. His first year covered most of what we call our calendar 538. In Daniel 9:2, it records that he now understood, Daniel understood, by the book, the number of 70 years for the desolations of Jerusalem. The land must rest for longer than 50 years of a jubilee cycle, which they had earlier neglected or compromised. It was now had rested for 70 years for both those only inadequately kept in the past, plus the remainder until the true Messiah would introduce the millennial Sabbath with a release from bondage. A full second year is never ascribed to Darius in Babylon, as Daniel had nothing more to record of his second year. It is noted that this older of the two rulers died and never completed a full second year in Babylon. For this reason, Jewish history considers the first year of Cyrus as a sole regency in Babylon, beginning very late in 537 until the autumn or fall of 536. It was with this first inaugural year that Cyrus made his amnesty decree in Ezra 1, verses 1 to 4, and 2 Chronicles 36, 22 and 23. It was a banner year for the Jews. Numerous historians mark the significance of this event in this very year. Here is one of many from Easton's Bible Dictionary. We read, "The first year of Cyrus, Ezra 1:1, is not the year of his elevation to power over the Medes, nor over the Persians, nor the year of the fall of Babylon, but the year succeeding the 2 years during which Darius the Mede was a viceroy in Babylon after its fall. At this time only, B.C. 536, Cyrus became actual king over Palestine, which became a part of the Babylonian Empire. The Edict of Cyrus for the rebuilding of Jerusalem marked a great epoch in the history of the Jewish people." And the article continues to cite 2 Chronicles and various chapters and verses in Ezra. Essentially, this same is repeated in the Encyclopedia McClintock and Strong's and several others. So it had been more than 3 years since Cyrus first marched into the Babylonian Empire. This year of Cyrus was the linchpin between all the biblical dating and subsequent secular history. It is used as a reliable date in history beyond which the Bible does not give us direct links anymore. Now, it will be noted that the first year of Cyrus's sole regency is regarded in Hebrew archives as the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, Ezra 1, verse 1. And here we want to pause with this slide. I don't know how we're using our time, but I want to pause here for just a moment. This page from volume 2 is really a hallmark page. It deserves a little attention. It's most simple in some ways. You're familiar with the page. It lists the lives of the patriarchs down to Abraham, the period of Abraham to the Exodus, the 40 years in the wilderness, and then the period of the conquering of the nations, the 450 years of the judges, 513 years of the kings, up until Cyrus, 536, which is circled on the screen. So we have all these periods of history, and I can't see the picture as clearly as you can, and maybe you can't see it either. But we have all these biblical links leading up to, if I can get my mouse to show on the screen, I'm not sure it is. I think we'll overlook this attempt to do that. But you see the point of Cyrus with the red line. From here, the Bible does not continue, and it continues only with 536 with secular history. Now, if there's any revision of those links of the period of the kings, the 70 years desolation, or the judges, then the 6,000 years does not end in 1872. So it's very important that we have a connecting point, as well as not revising any of the points before Cyrus. Take a look at that page a little more in your volumes. Ezra 1:1, this is the first year king of Persia. This verse introduces the records that were also a part of the state documents of Persia. Verses 2 and 3 record the amnesty decree, allowing Jews in Babylon to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. It became the legal document that surfaced some years later in the Persian library under another Darius Hystaspes, when fear and opposition stopped the work in Jerusalem for a time. The events are recorded in Ezra, the 4th chapter, the 5th chapter, and the 6th chapter. Now, the account in 2 Chronicles 36, 18 to 22, began with first removing the vessels and burning the temple until the decree to restore those vessels and restore the temple. This window of time is said to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. As long as she lay desolate, she fulfilled 70 years. Jeremiah prophesied of 70 years for the faulty Sabbaths recorded in Jeremiah 25, verse 11, and Jeremiah 34, 17 and 22. Now, brethren, I know that these texts have been microanalyzed for all the Hebrew grammatical forms of verbs, articles, prepositions, and so forth. and separating the prophecies into different 70-year periods. But regardless of the efforts to accommodate secular history and pagan records, I see Jeremiah's prophecies consistent with the singular divine judgments in Leviticus 26, 33-35, that the state records of Chronicles and Persia were that the decree of Cyrus was to complete a judgment of 70 years against the land, the throne, and the population. And therefore we can readily measure backward further in time those 70 years to determine when the land was desolate and Jerusalem fell. I know that it has been customary to reach even further back in history and to consider some other ancient secular dates and also reliable and form other events to reason that some Bible accounts should read differently, which proposes a shorter time for the desolating of the land until Cyrus, or a shorter period of the judges, or fewer years in the kings of Israel. But Christ returned at the right year in the chain of history and prophecy that began the seventh day. And so, the end time events also confirm the steps leading to the great seventh day. Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath, the greater than Cyrus, has also returned to us just 6,000 years since the eviction and exile from Eden that began human bondage to the prince of this world. The times of restitution occur at the antitypical Jubilee, the greater Sabbath. I am convinced that just as ancient Cyrus was the turning point between the sacred chain of history and the prophetic link to a secular record, that just so the antitypical Cyrus has now returned and is the link between the past secular history that has now introduced the grand prophetic Sabbath year, the year of Jubilee. The grand millennial day has begun. Brethren, we are not saying that those who regard a future seventh day would place his return as also being future. However, we see these events as being connected, and they should be connected. We understand the times of restitution began with the seventh millennium, the year of Jubilee. Apostle Peter described this day in his second letter in 2 Peter chapter 3 as the day of his parousia, the day when the ecclesiastical heavens and the civil earth face the judgmental fires even while they are willingly ignorant of the cause or the outcome. Peter saw the day of the Lord as a singular prophetic day, not different thousand-year periods. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day with the Lord this is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. He was looking toward this day in which the heavens are dissolved and bringing in the new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Not that it will be only righteousness, but righteousness will prevail. Truth will purge the darkness, He does not see it as 2 days or anything more or less than 1,000 years. The book of Jeremiah opens the last 11th year of Zedekiah. And he prophesies in Jeremiah 1, verse 10, I have set thee this day over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy, and to throw down, but also to build and to plant. Yes, to build and to plant. It is the work of one day to both destroy and to plant. At first, he is just seen as the general of Jehovah, as was Cyrus when he first came against the city. Yet he is the real power of the new kingdom. The householder did not know what to do with this intruder, but he felt secure within his walls. The supposed thief came in an hour that surprised him. The house, Satan's house, is being broken up. He used just 3.5 years in gathering his allies and his associates, while the world could only see the aging kingdoms of this world. He delivered the message in Revelation 18. Babylon the great has fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and behold, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. And so it has just been since 1878, 3.5 years after his presence. But then this same antitypical Cyrus, the anointed, exercised his singular power of the throne. Here is the greater call and release foreseen by Isaiah and Jeremiah for Jews to flee Babylon. When the new king sat on his throne, the Israelites indeed could return to their homeland and rebuild the temple with gold and silver vessels of divine truths. The seven angels came out of the antitypical temple, clothed with white linen, and the seven last plagues. Under this rule, the antitypical plagues complete the divine wrath, and they dry the river Euphrates, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Revelation 16:12. At the seventh trumpet, the kingdom of this world became our Lord's and is anointed. Because he has taken his great power and reigned, the nations are angry, the dead are judged, the saints are rewarded, and the destroyers of the earth are destroyed. Revelation 11:15-18. It is the day of the Lord. All this could not happen until the Lord of the Sabbath returned to administer this new day. Dear brethren, we are living in grand and awful times. You know, when I was a young man, I heard some of the old timers say that we should be awake and watching the dawn of the new day with the sun rising while the world is yet asleep in the darkness of their own nightmares. But it is later than they think. It is later than they want it to be. And I remembered that. As a young man, it's later than we think. Our king is marching on. We see our king. He has arrived at the times of restitution with healing in his wings. For those who welcome back the king, Malachi 4, verse 2. The resurrection of the sleeping saints are awakened. For those who do not accept the king, he is felt as a flaming sword. Such was not the lot of those who either bow to Cyrus or those who do not know. But those who recognize the king, he is not a flaming sword, but he rises with healing in his wings. It inspired me to watch the signs of this new day and to rejoice. Yet it is introduced with a trauma on the old order. Some may question if it is earlier than we thought or whether it is later. Brethren, are we still waiting for the new day? Maybe the millennial day has not begun. If Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath, did he arrive before the Sabbath? Is the year of Jubilee not quite here yet? I'm not of that persuasion. The year of Jubilee is opened with its own set of troubles. The arm of the Lord is also the king and introducing the new order. The king is at his gates. Even all Israel is not aware that it is the lion of the tribe of Judah that has opened the way. Even spiritual Israel are not all aware of the new king and kingdom. Some are waiting for the sunlight to flood the earth. Others are awake because they see the sun already rising. It is not earlier than you thought, nor are we still waiting for the dawn of the millennial day. It is here. Now, it is not altogether without notice that the greater than Cyrus returned in 1874. In 3.5 years of his presence as king, he took his great power to reject the house of Babylon in 1878. And just as Israel had endured 70 years removal from the land, so from 1878, there were also another 70 years in returning them from the diaspora to possess their land in 1948. Yes, it is later than some think. 6 days are past. The seventh day is already rising with the Jubilee trumpet. As with King David, who defeated his enemies, waited in Hebron, where some of his own stood with him, while others questioned his kingship, which had already begun. But, brethren, be ye not the last to welcome back the king. David's reign is counted from his anointing in Hebron and not later, when the nation decided to accept him and move to Jerusalem. The Lord regarded him as king from the beginning. And even now, the greater of Cyrus has entered the gates and upset the drunken tables of Babylon, just as he did at the first advent. And he has made his decree to flee Babylon and to return to his temple with vessels of present truth. The Lord of the Sabbath is ushering in the grand sabbatic year. 6 days are past. The year of Jubilee has come. Let us be careful to bear the vessels of the Lord with those sacred truths once delivered to the saints and now restored to Zion. The harvest message of truth, present truth, is in those vessels. May the Lord add his blessing.